Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A few weeks ago, my partner started playing Stardew Valley. I need a soft, sweet game, she said, and she'd been pretty taken with that. With what she'd seen over my shoulder as I went about my routines of feeding chickens, tending gardens, and giving gifts to friends. So she gave it a try. This weekend, she announced, in a tone heavy with regret and shame, I think I have brought industrial farming to Stardew Valley. I glanced at her laptop to see what she was talking about and felt like Neo as Morpheus showed him the vast human battery farms beneath the blotted out sky. Those are the words of one Rob Zachney in his piece this week, When a Game Becomes a Troubling Psychological Self-Portrait. I'm Danielle Riendo. This is Waypoint Radio, episode 136. And joining me today is the man who wrote those words himself, Mr. Rob Zachney.
Hey, everybody. Greetings from the newly industrialized Stardew. Yeah.
Excellent. Beautiful. Also joining me, of course, is Austin Walker.
On my farm, we just kind of roll out of bed at 11 and then just kind of like make things happen. But here's the big one is, you know how you're supposed to go to bed?
Yeah.
We just don't do that on my farm. We just stay up all night farming all night.
This sounds like a psychological self-portrait.
On Waypoint Farm. Yep.
On the Waypoint Content Farm. And of course, we also have Patrick Klepek.
Is farming a euphemism on your farm, Austin? I feel like when you say farming, you don't mean what the rest of us mean.
No, I mean farming. I mean farming.
Yeah?
I'm talking about farming.
See, now
the more you
say it, the less certain I become of your meaning.
Talking about farming.
He's talking about farming. Well, mm-hmm. Okay, if you mean farming,
I mean farming. Yeah, okay.
I get it.
Okay, we're farming.
You're farming.
Say no more.
Farming.
Farming.
It means you're fighting Negragante 7 times in a row so yep. You can get that armor, so you can get that rank
exactly.
7. So you can get that extra sharpening layer so that you don't have to be sharpening. You got that blue layer. Got that blue layer. You get, good.
Gotta get the blue
wow.
layer.
Wow. Gotta get that blue laser, too.
I've only got one weapon with the blue layer, and it drives me up a wall every time I switch to a different weapon.
Yeah, that blue one's
good. And my sharpness is only a green.
I know, Patrick.
I feel like there's a lot of psychological weight here mm-hmm. that's going on with your farming and his sharpening. And Rob, I guess it's your topic this week, more or less, because this is something you wrote about on Monday. But about the general concept of when you play a game and you see yourself reflected, perhaps in a very disturbing way, in this game or in your habits in the game. So it seems like, first of all, I guess I should ask, is your partner doing okay? Does she get over what she's done to the poor people of Stardew Valley?
Maybe a little bit. As I understand it, there have been some interesting developments since I wrote that story.
Oh.
There's a burgeoning relationship with Elliot, the novelist, that I'm excited to see how it turns out. It could be the things are about to get a little more chill on Mooberry Farm, as I think it's called.
What name? Mooberry?
Yeah.
Mooberry?
Yeah, don't worry about it.
What's the
good.
Etymology of Mooberry?
I have no idea. Look,
you know
I don't
mulberry?
Know.
It's like a mulberry, but more milky.
Right.
Oh,
look,
delicious. Look,
it's partly like a forage farm. It's uh-huh. partly a dairy farm. And there's a lot of adorable, soft, sweet creatures that need to be pet every day. So I think it's, pretty much clear what the etymology of that term is. But, yeah, obviously, once a phenomenon has been observed, it begins to change. But I think what's really interesting about sort of what was happening, when my partner was playing Stardew, is that explicitly, Stardew, you go to play Stardew for what you think is one kind of fantasy experience, right? Like, Stardew opens with literally, your elderly grandfather being like, someday when the modern world becomes too much for you, and you need to escape it all, then you will know what to do with this gift. And so explicitly, it's about get away from these horrible, destructive rhythms and patterns of modern life and come to slow, sleepy, sweet, communitarian Stardew. That's kind of the fantasy. And then what happens when you go into a game and you bring yourself to that fantasy, and it turns out you completely transform it. That's what I find really interesting, is like when a game isn't supposed to really like sort of like flatter or model your weird tics, but somehow you make it do that anyway.
So Stardew Valley is the cave from Empire Strikes Back, is what you're saying.
Yeah, pretty
it
much.
Shows you your darknesses and your dark sides and all of those things.
Right. Well, the Stardew thing for me was actually like the opposite of the thing I pitched before.
Yeah.
Which was like, I had to quit playing Stardew Valley because I felt like if I wasn't optimizing it, I was playing wrong. And so like, I just couldn't do it. Like, I couldn't. And it wasn't the farm. It was everything. It's like, okay, I need to be progressing down every path with the best efficiency possible. And that made it not fun at all for me. And, like, any of the joy I would have gotten out of, like, hey, this is, like, the creative element of kind of, kind of putting together what crops I was going to make and putting together, like, what my farm looked like and any sort of the joy I was getting out of characters. Like, all of that was pushed to the side because I felt bad if I wasn't spending every day very, very, very productively. And it was just, like, not a healthy experience in any way. It was, like, reinforcing really bad behaviors of overworking and shit. So I stopped.
I see why you like Souls games.
Right.
Makes perfect sense that sort of mindset is the only way you forge ahead,
I guess,
in one type of game.
The thing is, the Souls games are – it's the opposite thing for me though, which is I like Souls games partially because I don't mind when I lose and don't make progress.
Oh.
Right? Like I don't get that mad when I fuck up and get killed at a boss unless it's like – one of those one moments of like, oh, it had no health left and I fucked up I got greedy. Exactly.
One more hit.
One more hit and I shouldn't have done it. Or the opposite, which is I could have snuck the hit in and I got scared and didn't commit. But the thing with Souls games for me is actually like I don't have a particularly antagonistic relationship with those games. If I die, I die. Like, I'll go get my souls. If I don't get my souls, I don't get my souls. Like, okay. And so I have, like, a very chill relationship with those games. But it's games in which optimization is visible and is, like, in which I can clearly see what an optimized run would look like and then I fail to do it is where it feels bad.
I remember, like, part of the reason that Stardew just didn't grab me. Those games just aren't usually my sort of thing, even as I tried. But I had a similar experience to Austin where rather than me being able to recognize my own failings to optimize because I couldn't see that to begin with because I just don't play those types of games. Instead, I'd go on Twitter and see other people's farms, and then I'd look at mine and go, all right, I guess I just don't understand these games because I'm so fucking bad at it. And so it just like – then I just like turned it off and just moved on to the next thing because it was like I looked at my dinky thing and I was like, I don't – and most of this was like me talking to Geeta Jackson about her farm because she was extremely good at farming and efficiencies and maximize everything. And I'd like talk to her. I'd see her farm and just go, okay, like, yep, this is just maybe not – or just the mountain I was going to have to climb to – one, it was a mountain to climb to understand to reach those like efficiencies on a mental level. And two, I just – same way that I've never really been into strategy games, like certain games reflect upon my weaknesses psychologically that like could I compensate for them by like learning more? Maybe. But often it's just why do I want to play something that's going to continually remind me like I'm just not good at this sort of thing? Why bang my head at it?
Right. I think it's funny you bring up strategy games because as Danielle mentioned earlier, we've been doing stuff with Blue Lasers lately we streamed Stellaris yesterday. Stellaris has a new expansion pack called Apocalypse. And I think that ended up being a really interesting test case for this to some degree, which was we set out to build Stellaris is a 4X game sort of in the vein of Civilization or something. It takes place in outer space. It's by Paradox, who makes Crusader Kings 2. So it has kind of a hint of the sort of what we call grand strategy in the genre, which is less about the kind of four X's, less about expansion and exploitation and the other two X's.
We're looking at Rob, like, what are the other?
Extermination.
And expansion. Did I already say?
Ex-girlfriend.
Expansion. Expansion is the one I missed. It still does all of those, but, like, there's a little bit more nuance in there. There's more, a little bit more in terms of, like, there's a little more character, it feels, and there's a really long middle period of just like, okay, things are arranged, and now how will they interact? And we set out to build our ideal, like, space empire.
We sure did.
And I say space empire, but I should say, like, collectivist, full luxury space communism.
Space DSA, I think is how we put it.
Exactly. But, and we kind of had this idealistic notion of like, okay, what if Earth was good? What if we figured out how to make Earth good, and then we went to space, and we built, I think, a culture that I can get behind. And then the thing happened that always happens, which is we ran into other people. And it was really interesting to immediately be put into a position of, should we, like, should we go in on our own ethics? Should we completely fold and deal with these evil space
cultures?
That's
the thing. We gotta explain the fact of why the other cultures were evil. They were all slavers. Every single species we encountered were like despotic slavers.
Yeah.
Every single one.
Which is
wild. It was rough.
Well, and it was one of those things that, like, immediately the thing ended up being like, well, are these space slavers really as bad as these other space slavers? Like, and like, well, maybe it just says they're space slavers. Maybe they don't have any real slaves. We should try to get some information. Oh, they have real slaves.
Yep. And it was like they're unhappy if they don't have slaves. There was like an extra condition on top of this that was like they're really
those
unhappy
are the worst ones. That's
when
the thing.
They don't have slaves.
Right. So like, that was the thing. It was like, okay, could we team up with the evil slavers who at least they're not predisposed to having slaves? Maybe we could change their mind one day versus the other evil empire that was like they need slaves or they're not happy, which is fucked.
Yeah.
And
so you didn't liberate any of these people?
We tried, okay. Patrick.
So this was
wow.
Good.
I just touched it. I just saw the whole room react. A nerve was like physically brought into the world, and I pinched it.
So to a degree, the history of this galaxy has yet to be written.
Yes.
First of all, our government had other priorities at this time. Like while the governing council was really excited about sort of a liberationist movement across the galaxy. The popular will was pretty centered on deep space mining operations.
They're big on mining.
While there were a lot of like sentient beings being held in bondage, really people just needed to strip mine some asteroids, and then we could deal with the other stuff.
We are fanatic egalitarians, and the minerals in those asteroids must be free. And we just had to free them out, you know? Yeah.
So you're saying there was a different kind, like, they were stuck in this asteroid. That was their own sort of enslavement.
Funny story.
Yeah,
oh, no.
Actually.
So speaking of people being stuck inside asteroids.
So we found, there was a point at which, okay, so you have to understand, for three terms
hey,
in a
Austin,
row.
Austin, all good stories start with, look, what you should understand, like, I'm not racist,
right,
but
like, I hear you. But we, three terms in a row, had the goal of increasing the amount of mining that was happening in outer space. Three different executive officers. They're called aspirants in our culture.
Aspirants.
We aspire to greatness.
Also, you choke on them.
And also, you choke on them.
Sorry,
go on. Well, yeah. And we found a star surrounded by an incredibly dense asteroid belt that had 40 mineral points. Yeah, in it. You have to understand, most whole systems only have 3, 4, 5 mineral points.
A lot of points.
40 now, mineral points.
Another key piece of context here.
Yeah, please.
So Austin was driving the stream. He was sort of in control of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And you get
okay,
little updates
the sound, I'm
from...
starting to see where the contours of this, whatever you're about to justify here momentarily.
Yeah, you get little updates from like various departments within your empire. Mm. And like,
you get a lot of them, I want to be clear.
Yeah.
There's
so,
a lot of them. Like my email box.
Yeah, so like the dweebs in the science division sent in this exploration report on this really mineral-rich, bizarrely mineral-rich system with all these asteroids. And they were like, huh, these are these fascinating asteroids with lots of minerals. And there are these other interesting characters. And then Austin like just closed the message and moved on.
There were 40 minerals there, Rob.
And started building the mines.
Later, what we would learn is... That message included a sub-message that said that there were also the remains of countless mining stations, what had come before. And the second we finished the final mine, because they're split up, there's like 8 of them, right? And each one has 5 mineral points in it. And we get to the last one, and like seconds later, it's like, the asteroids all begin to rumble as microscopic creatures begin to pour from their pores on their surface and become a living swarm that begins to devastate all of your mining operations.
Patrick, it was dope as hell. You could barely see them.
You couldn't even
you
see them.
Like,
you just zoom
you'd be
in
looking
super
at the system.
Close.
Yeah, like things are dying in the system, but like you couldn't tell, and it wasn't until like we stared at it for like 5 minutes watching like a system's worth of miners like perish brutally. And then we're like, holy shit, wait, like those little like particles are like killer bugs.
Yeah. Just
saying, so this is like The Happening, right?
Right.
Like, a little bit.
Yes.
But also exactly like we happening also brought it on ourselves.
A little
like,
bit.
We went just and like right, you're right, you're right, you're wow correct. True. That is correct.
Well, and here's the thing.
These things were like, they were enslaved by their asteroid, and then they rose up to fight us, the oppressors.
I don't know that we're the, I guess that's, well, here's what I want to know
we were
is,
stealing their minerals.
If we had, if they had let us have those minerals,
that's their juice,
we could have liberated all those other people.
I see.
Why did the,
so were they, were they using the minerals to survive?
See, they
who
weren't.
Could say?
They, I mean,
well, they were trying to protect their territory. Yeah.
Convenient ignorance, Austin
who
Walker.
Could say?
Who could say? There's lots of possibilities. Right.
I mean, look, the dweebs didn't spend enough time figuring that part out.
They didn't.
Yeah, I mean, look,
they
could have.
That was
not
sub
complete
message
their work before we started changing the environment. But, you know, like, look, bees need honey, but they don't need all of it.
Right. And listen, we've made the. Exactly. Exactly. You know who else needs honey? Me and my tea. We met yes big elephant people on a different planet, and yes then we had a good relationship with them because they were like, cool, we're gonna be friends.
The cool titans.
And now they were like, some of them wanted to join our army, which is a weird first fucking desire man to have after meeting a new type of people. But they are in our army now.
Hey, maybe they knew hi what side so, they needed to be on.
Right.
So they're like, hey.
Right.
So, there were all these slaving empires.
Right.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And everyone, the moment we realized, the moment we met our second slaving empire, we realized, like, we're starting to get outnumbered by slavers. And we were like, we need to do something about this. The problem is, we'd sort of set up a really idyllic and peace-oriented society. But we're looking at the numbers and we're like, I think we can first strike annihilate these people. Like, sort of looking around, like, are we going to do this? Like, should we do this? And so we passed an edict. And we sort of changed up what okay, so basically we became neoconservatives.
Well, okay, slow down. We became freedom fighters.
Isn't that what neocons call
actually
themselves?
So mechanically, yes. Mechanically, we actually did something very good, which is previously we were able to – in this game, you have to have a reason to go to war. You can't just go to war. And previously, we could go to war with anybody we
yeah
said –
yeah, you have to leak stuff to the New York Times, have them write it up, and then use that to justify yep your invasion.
Yep.
Right. So, I mean, previously, all we had to do was say, you're a rival, fuck you. We're going to go to war with you. We can do it with anybody. Anybody.
Or you can just be, you can just be aggro and
yes
that's your justification.
So we okay changed that to be where we could only do – we could declare rivals with someone. And then if our, if we were ideologically opposed, we could then declare an ideological war that was about changing how they ran their government. And so we okay were trying to get them to give up slavery. But because we ran out of minerals, we didn't have the ability to like – hit them when they were weak, and now we're back to like square one, and we've met a third one. And all of this is to say that get to what Danielle's entire topic is that like it's funny because this strategy game about spaceships and space bugs left us all, I think, feeling like how do you navigate politically in a world where there's so much where so much compromise could also look like, you know, what's the word? What's the word I'm looking for? The Chamberlain word? The
Appeasement?
Appeasement, oh, exactly. Yes. Thankfully, where so much compromise can look like appeasement, where someone who you disagree with politically can look like, you know, if you're working with them, you're betraying some really deep fundamental values. And it actually, like, hit, I think, me at least. I don't know if it hit everybody
oh
else.
Oh, yeah.
I was just like, well, fuck. Like, I want to be hardline about this. But, like, I turned towards Danielle as our moral center, and, like, mm-hmm we ended up, like, kind of just kind of going hands off, but hoping the other evil empires would fight each other.
It was really hard.
Yeah.
It was really, really hard.
That stream
because
will be
this
up
game keeps asking me to make those decisions.
Right.
And I keep wanting to be, like, a Captain Janeway or a Captain Picard right here and be like, no.
Right.
This is below us. We're the Federation, the United Federation of Planets.
Right.
We value diversity.
Right, but
everyone else is a slaver.
Right.
And we were very worried because we have that deviant quality, which
I forgot
in this
about
case
that
meant that our populace could deviate from its original ideology.
Right.
We were worried the slavers were going to rub off on our people.
Not like, literally, hopefully.
Well, yeah.
Deviant.
You know, I don't know.
I don't know.
Deviants.
Well, that was the thing. Is like we literally built a society that was like constantly self-checking itself and thinking, well, what if other people have good ideas? But then the other people all ended up being slavers.
Slaving despots.
So, I don't know. We're going to pick that game up next week.
It's going to be.
And I think we're going to keep hitting this thing of like, and this has been true for me. I don't know, Rob, you've played a lot of these games. I don't know, Danielle, if you've dipped into strategy games before. But I've actually had this dilemma, which is like, I actually think that mechanically there are some cool things that happen with sorts of gameplay styles that I won't play. So this new update adds a sort of like a system where you can be kind of Viking style or pirate style, where you like take you kidnap people, you go on raids, kidnap people, or like space alien style, like UFO style, like oh you attack
research
to kidnap people and then like bring them back, and you can bring them into your culture, or you can use them as slaves or blah blah blah. And I'm like I want to play space Vikings. But I kind of never want to be the culture in a game that is a slavery culture ever.
Right.
Even weird sci-fi bullshit space Vikings. And that's not a bummer in any way, but it is one of those weird lines that I have drawn, even though that wouldn't change my feelings about, for instance, slavery, or wouldn't, you know, I don't think that that would be like some failure of me or anyone else who plays the game. It's just like this weird thing that I can't quite push past.
I have – this is not exactly the same thing, but it's along those lines. I never don't play as the most goody-ass, goody-two-shoes character in anything I can play.
No one ever pushes you? Like, there's never any bad guy who's
I'm
like –
I'm not
you know
about
what?
Violence.
Okay.
Not by any means. I'm not a pacifist by any means in games.
Right.
But like in Dishonored 2, for example, and Death of the Outsider, you know, games where you can decide to like –
be
violent.
Right.
I was violent, but I never killed anybody.
Right.
I knocked everybody out, and I put them in a nice, safe place in the recovery position. I actually made sure to put them in the recovery position.
But there's never been
corpse
anybody.
Skull.
Yeah.
There's even in Death of the Outsider. So I can think of a specific time in Death of the Outsider where it would have been very easy for me to not kill somebody, and I killed them anyway. Which is there's a room. It's like very, very light spoilers in Death of the Outsider. There's a room where you find rich people who like sit in chairs. They're Peter Thiele.
Mm.
They're like,
oh, this is the blood room.
The blood room where there's like rich folks who
fuck
are
fuck those motherfuckers.
Fuck those guys.
Boom, boom, boom,
right.
Boom.
They're like
Danielle. If you didn't kill them, I actually have lost respect for you for allowing them to survive.
There are these rich motherfuckers who sit in chairs, like hooked up to an IV. And
oh,
they're draining
room.
Blood from a poor dude in the other room. And that's all they do all day. That's like their vacation. They go to a spa and they hook up an IV and they sit in a comfortable chair and they get new blood put in them from a living person.
You can
person.
Literally walk up to them and just stab them
like,
in the
you know what?
They're asleep. They're eventually, like, what's great about that moment is, like, eventually they – you walk in. There's some dialogue. And then they pass out. Like, they kind of go into a dream state, like a – some sort of whatever the equivalent of like the high that you get from this blood transaction, and then they're just there. And I remember stabbing the guard in the neck, and then they're just sitting there.
Yeah.
They're just sitting. There's two witches off to the side talking in another room, and then there's these three just lined up, and I just clunk, clunk, clunk.
There you
felt
go.
No. Now, granted, I did play like a violent playthrough because I felt like it fit the character and.
Sure.
How they wanted to achieve their means. And in my interpretation of that character, it felt like a betrayal not to be violent because it seemed like that's what the character's proclivity was towards. Violence is a means of achieving something, not violence just for the sake of being like sociopathic.
Right.
But that room in particular was one where I took zero like remorse. Like it felt very much like these are bad people. They actually don't deserve to live. And so fuck them.
Done.
Yeah.
We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. Nothing.
That's fair.
They didn't push you over
I'm
the
trying
edge.
To remember, like, four people died in my entire playthrough. They may have been among them. There was one guard. I got so pissed. I put, like, 25 hours into this one level trying to make it perfect.
Oh,
and there
no.
was one guard who, like, fell into the river or something. When I wasn't looking, I think there was, like, some whatever. There's, like, a wind thing or something.
A seagull hit him. Who
I
the fuck knows?
I was really annoyed. Because the guards are just doing their job.
I'm
not saying that's morally okay. However,
guards especially, like, things aren't as bad in Karnaca by that point as they were during the main Death of the Outside, or the main Dishonored 2. So it's not even like they're, like, fascist guards at that point,
They're just doing their job.
Yeah.
Look, again, I'm not saying that just because you're wearing the uniform, you're morally fine.
Sure.
I don't want to kill you. I don't want to be responsible for
that death.
You'll
knock you the fuck out.
Exactly.
But
everybody, I went high assault, low fatalities, mm-hmm. I think was the term for like the X and Y and how it went. Like,
tell it to the judge.
Nobody didn't see me coming. Right. They all saw me coming.
I don't know how that body ended up in the water, sir.
I think it was a seagull, sir. I don't know.
That was the wind. You know how magic works.
You know?
Have you heard of the outside?
Yeah.
Have you heard
probably
the good
that
word?
Guy.
Yeah,
so yeah, like, there's no one in an RPG or anything has ever pushed you because they're such a villain. We're like, you know what? Fuck off. Boom.
I think that's happened before.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay.
Which I'm fine with. And I'm also like, would be perfectly fine using violence in real life for self-defense.
No one is doubting
100,000%.
You made that like, clear with those space pirates who tried to blow us up. So.
I mean, like, somebody tries to blow you up, you have every right
absolutely.
To blow them up. But I think it's very much like an element of my personality. Like, I have a little hero complex. Like, of course I love riding around in my little ambulance and helping sick people in real life. That's fun
you
for me.
You don't punch people while doing that, right?
Only if it's necessary, Austin.
True. Good answer.
No, you don't.
Good
we answer. Don't. We don't do that. That's not a thing that we do. We are only allowed to use soft restraints on violent patients, which we've had to do.
Have you ever wanted to brawl with another EMT company?
There you go.
Oh, yes. Yes, I've wanted that.
Oh,
I haven't done it in uniform, but, you know.
Wait, what was...
If they came to my gym and I was like, hey, what's up?
You want to fight?
You want to spar?
Work some things out.
You know.
Do you have, like, EMT rivals?
Not like rivals, because we're the Volunteers. Okay, here in real life, like...
Is that the name of your gang, the Volunteers? That's a sick name.
The Ridgewood Volunteer
I
Ambulance
volunteer
Corps.
I volunteer to beat the shit out of you.
I mean, that's what we are.
So
what... signed up for this, Riando.
Really,
I know what your problem is.
Man.
Wait, what's
you
the
don't,
hierarchy?
You don't want to do this. Don't get in the bus.
Yeah, don't get on the bus if you can't hold yourself in. We really are the Volunteers, and we really are, like, helping the other crews that are gotcha. Out there, like the FDNY people. So, like, they're usually happy because that means they can go smoke or, like, eat something. Mm-hmm. And we're like, all right, we'll deal with your patient. Like, we got them. We're going to carry them in and help them. So
everything's actually good. Everything's
actually
what you're
good.
Actually painting is a very kind
the Volunteers
picture.
Are actually very nice.
Good.
We try to be. But, yeah, it's very much that. And the other thing for me, for sure, and this also, of course, has to do with immersive sims because that's what I like to play. Like, my personality, I love to tinker. I love to tinker with things. I love to tinker with variables. I like, you know, we do a little game dev stream. I like to build and play with things. So immersive sims are fun for me because I get to spend, you know, say 80 hours in a 20-hour game trying every single thing, every single interaction, every single little thing I get to pick and pull and play with, which I guess is like a somewhat positive personality trait. It's like, oh, it's fun to play with variables. I'd rather do that than play a lot of games that have a more directed path, for example.
Right. So. Which is like, again, that's fine, but it's the I think this gets to the Rob's question, your question of like, hey, like, what are games that bring out that side of us or bring out that let you see into yourself in a weird way and go like, oh, that's me.
I'm a dork who just loves to play with variables. Yeah, exactly.
What's funny, I think, is games sometimes, I think a lot of these examples have been not negative necessarily, but we've kind of been talking about it almost pathologically. It's like, what dark secret do games reveal from us? And I'm actually curious if any of you have the opposite, which is like, oh, I didn't know I had this in me. This game helped show this. For me, Starbound, which is like Terraria but spacey, which is like I guess Minecraft but 2D and in space.
Sure.
I got really into decorating my spaceship, and like you could tear apart the internals of the spaceship and then kind of build little dioramas basically, and they could look really cool, and you could kind of like use the items you found across all the different worlds and make, you know, here's my little bedroom, it's like on a loft above
that's
the kitchen.
Cute. Yeah.
So I built like, you know, 6 or 7 different ones that I was really proud of that had like really great color schemes. I was like, a game has never brought that out in me before. But I guess I really like this style of visual storytelling. So I'm curious for y'all, if a game has ever been like, oh, wow, I didn't know I had this positive trait or that I could engage in this way. Maybe the opposite of Patrick's thing, which was like Stardew says, oh, I can't play games like this. Anything that like made you feel like, oh, wow, I can play games like this. I could do this other big stuff.
Yeah. Well, Patrick, I know you and Danica both have said things about Monster Hunter in that way, or like in terms of like stats.
Yeah,
and weapons,
Monster Hunter. So I think Monster Hunter had like a greater impact on Danica.
Sure,
when she like spoke to like the idea of like item management. Like, I mean, there's a pretty strong through line between Dark Souls and Monster Hunter.
Sure,
like,
sure.
That I like knew to some extent, but didn't quite internalize until I actually sat down, and it was more just like Dark Souls has fewer systems going on than Monster Hunter, and or different systems, right? Like, I've internalized that of Dark Souls' weird, stats and how it manages a lot of other different things. But, like, Monster Hunter, Dark Souls, like, if you like one, there's a good chance you're going to like the other one. So I don't know that Monster Hunter necessarily hit for me in that way. I'm trying to think of a game that didn't positively. Often it's usually for me, as Austin framed, in the negative sense, where it's like games like scratch at a certain nerve or like push on a certain nerve that just reminds me, like, I've just never been good at this sort of thing. And like, those games just remind me of that, and so I just kind of move on for them. So I'll have to try and think if there's a game that does the opposite of. I can't really think of one right off the top of my head.
How about you, Rob? Do you have something that was like...
Yeah, see, mostly it's pathologies all the way down. because most of the time... Okay, something positive is revealed. Usually, like, what you're seeking out is something that you're drawn to for some reason because it's already speaking to some aspect of your personality. Yeah. And so I guess that is kind of the problem, is when I'm... like getting some sort of positive feedback from a game, it's usually flattering something I already perceive about myself or would like to perceive about myself. And this sort of like surprise aspect is a little bit harder to come by. Like, I guess I tend to be surprised at how, like you, Danielle, I tend to be a goody two shoes. Like, it turns out my morality is a bit less flexible than I would maybe like. For the purposes of role-playing, I would like to be able to flex it a bit more. Like, I love reading Machiavelli's The Prince and the Discourses. Why can I never govern in a 4X strategy game as if I am Machiavelli, sort of putting those lessons into practice? Like, I come to that moment, and I'm like, yeah, like, the self-interested, like, thing to do here is betray this person while they're weak and completely gut them. But what I end up doing instead is being like, I really need to let them strike first,
and then
I'll be justified in doing whatever I have to do. But like, until they throw that first punch, I can't burn their cities and salt the earth.
Well, it's funny because it feels like when we play Stellaris together, you let yourself take that role a little bit in a way that you probably wouldn't if it was just your permanent Iron Man game where you were like, I can't take any of this back. This is me.
Well, because I know Danielle's on the other shoulder. Gotcha. Being like, talk to the pirates. And
that's what sorry, I sound that's, like.
That's Jiminy Cricket.
Oh, wow.
Like, talk to the pirates. Like,
You're Jiminy Cricket, and I'm
evil Jiminy Cricket.
Yeah, I got nothing actually.
I think it's heartless Jiminy Cricket. Kingdom Hearts is obviously.
I see. Yeah, yeah. It's all tied together.
Who's an evil?
I think. Oh, go ahead.
No, I'm just trying to figure out if Jiminy has a dark, like, reverse side.
The donkey one, right? Whoever turns Pinocchio into a donkey. Who does that?
That guy.
Is that alcohol?
He gives a weird beer.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's really weird. Yeah. Thinking about that.
Actually, that movie kind of sucks. It's too surreal. I don't like it. Patrick.
Okay.
I don't have a Pinocchio take. I probably haven't seen that movie since I was like six.
God.
I feel like now I got to go back. I've been trying to get my kid to watch 2D movies. Not interested.
Oh, no.
3D or bust.
Wow, really?
I don't think that's because she dislikes 2D movies. She's just only watched 3D films. And so, like, this even extends to Trolls. Loves the movie Trolls. Trolls, the 2D Netflix cartoon show, thinking like, great. I don't have to watch this 60-minute movie anymore. I can watch these bite-sized 20-minute cartoon that don't have the voices of Anna Kendrick and Justin Timberlake, but she doesn't know that.
Right.
She won't watch them. They're 2D. Anyway.
Have you tried anime?
Yeah, that's what I was going to guess.
We got to see if she has a reaction to certain lights and
never,
patterns first.
Never too young for shonen.
Exposure to anime.
Let me tell you about Goku and how he's here to save us.
Oh,
yeah, he's
the good word of
he's
Goku.
The good word of Goku. Have you heard the good word of Goku?
No, I haven't.
Oh my God.
But I was going to say that, like, I think this is something we've touched on before, that, like, when we struggle over this question of games that have pushed us in a direction that is a proclivity vastly different than what we would normally just operate on, I think it's a failure that more games don't, like, find ways to press play. Because I think the vast majority of players are the, like, they want to tell themselves they're the Han Solo type, but they are just the goody-two-shoe type, like, and they tell themselves they're the Han Solo type that will occasionally do a bad thing, but they actually aren't that person and don't ever do that occasional bad thing. I wish more games put you in a position where you had to make where you had to go in a direction that made you feel uncomfortable, and there wasn't another way around it. Because I think you can generally assume that most players want to be the good person, and not that you need to be the, like, I guess bad is the wrong way, but just I wish more games made me feel uncomfortable about the choices I was making instead of always giving me an out. Because in the same way that if I can play a game the exact same way to be effective, I'm going to lean in that direction. If games are morally going to give me an out 99% of the time, I'm going to take that choice 99% of the time. And even if you can say, oh, well, I'll just play it a second time and
you won't.
Do the different playthrough, that's vastly different than the first time, because inevitably the first playthrough is your canonical playthrough. The other ones are just like, what are other ways this could have gone, that you don't actually feel the same weight of making that choice the first time around. And I think games would be serviced not by be the bad guy. It's more just like in the context of like you want to do good. Like what if you can't?
What if good is hard to do? Hard to achieve.
Yeah. What if good is hard to do? And I don't know if enough games necessarily give you trade-offs in that direction.
Yeah.
There it is.
Hey, that Witcher 3, that's a hell of a game right there.
I keep thinking about going back to that game.
It's so good, Witcher Wednesdays.
I have one day.
Something I'm thinking about while you're saying this, Patrick, is I feel like that's actually a feature of games, of the types of games that are in the mainstream, is like, I think one of the reasons why a lot of people play games is because they get to actually affect change in a universe and be the most important thing in the universe. Maybe because you don't feel that in your real life, because who does, right? Very few people actually feel powerful in their lives.
At least it's clean in games.
That's my read on this, like in a clean way. Yeah, like I get to be the hero. I get to have sex with all the alien babes or whatever.
Is that Han Solo again?
Han Solo.
That's Danielle Riendo.
Danielle Riendo, exactly. Solo. Right. Morgana.
So my question, there's two things here. One is like, is this something that games should be incentivizing mechanically or disincentivizing like the good action by making it more difficult or by saying your skill in being a good person is actually not that high, my guy. Like, you don't have the courage to do this good thing. You're going to have to take this compromise. Or is this a failure in writing and in content design in which like what there should be is the sorts of choices and the sorts of situations that organically bring compromised morality out of a player. And this isn't a should as in like all games need this, but which one of those sounds more interesting to you or that you would like to see more of?
I mean, both.
Yeah.
But I also love immersive sims, so, you know.
True.
Go ahead, Rob. Go.
No, but like two examples I'll give real quick. One is that the end of Stalker, the original Stalker, has different endings you can get. You are spending the entire game trying to get to what's called the Wish Granter, somewhere in the center of the exclusion zone. It's like this magical thing that all the stalkers talk about, but like nobody's sure it even exists. And when you get there, the game sort of like interprets how you've played. You see yourself grant yourself a witch.
Don't pick this. This isn't a choice that you're grabbing from a menu or something.
Right. No, the game picks for you based on what you've done.
Yeah. You made that choice 12 hours ago when you killed that guy and took his shotgun or whatever. Right.
And I don't know how granular it is. I've never watched all the endings to Stalker, but the ending I got, and I felt I'd been pretty good. Like, you know, I shot back at people who had it coming, but like, I wasn't out there like massacring everyone in my path. I got to the end of the game and I get this cutscene of my character encountering the Wish Granter. And just like sort of staring up at it, so you're in the sarcophagus basically over the power plant, and he basically says, "I want to be rich." And then he imagines like this cascade of gold coins like falling down around him. But then you cut to what's actually happening. He's in an empty room, but some of the wreckage is starting to crumble around him. But like in his like delirious hallucinatory state, he becomes convinced that like he's getting his wish.
Right.
He's getting all the gold in the world, and ends with him getting buried. And that did kind of fit because I had played through that game basically hoovering up anything that wasn't nailed down.
Right.
Like, I was like, look, this is morally neutral, as I'm like just stuffing like gear and equipment inside my pockets, like just hoarding cash and ammunition, like looting every single corpse. But in that lineage, the other example that I'd say was really effective here, I really liked how the Metro games ended. The particularly Metro 2033, which frames everything as this. There's this looming threat from these monsters, Homo Novus, which are like the sort of mutated post-nuclear apocalypse version of humans. And they are, like, threatening to wipe out humanity in those tunnels. And the question is, like, what do we do about them? How do we prevent this from happening? And at the end of the game, like, you start getting, like, this feeling that they're trying to communicate with you specifically. Mm. But you're still going about this mission to sort of deal with this problem once and for all as the other human factions understand it. And so the really cool thing is, because I'd basically not played with a great deal of empathy up to that point, like when people ask me, like, can you spare some money? Can you spare, well, ammunition? Can you spare some gear and equipment, ammunition? I'd be like, sorry, not really. I need this to probably kill some future Nazis or some monsters in the tunnels. I'd love to help you, kid.
Right.
I'm sorry about your mom and dad and everyone you know in this in this train station, but like... I got needs too,
right?
And it's to shoot people. And so at the end of the game, it reveals that like what you thought the situation was is not remotely accurate. That they aren't monsters at all. This is a new sentient species that wants to coexist with humanity. Has been trying to reach out to these people they instinctively recognize as like sentient cousins, and you understand this when it's far too late to affect the course of things.
Right.
And so the ending I got was like, you drop the nukes on them.
Right.
Like you hit them as they're begging you basically to not do this. You hit them with the nuke, and it's this upsetting moment. But what I really liked about it was there were all these little choices that were indicating like how my character interacted with the world. Like what were my values actually? Like when it was a hard choice, when it actually cost me resources and therefore like some sort of like well-being, did I take an open-handed, open-hearted approach to the world? The answer was I didn't. And so the game is like those big decisions, the big, you know, the moral forks in the road are actually preceded usually by tons of little small decisions. Right. And those are the ones that actually define us. Like that moment where you get to be the hero and make the virtuous decision, that's easy. It's those little day-to-day decisions, those small ones. Those are the hard ones to get right.
And those are the ones that
that game brought that out.
Those are the ones that prep you to make those big ones, right? Like I love that it basically forecloses the possibility of you being the person who would make that bold decision because fucking you couldn't even spare some change, my guy. How are you supposed to stop nuclear holocaust? And that's – I think it's really interesting. That's an interesting flip too on the question, right, which is like games judging us by the way we play. It's like judging you by your actions instead of your words. It's easy to select the option that says speech 75, no, don't fight the ghouls. It's way harder to be this
– It's speech 100. That's the end of New Vegas. It's speech 100. You got to put all your points into it in order to prevent it. I'm just saying it's not 75. You had to put 100 points in there to do it.
Well, I mean – so actually maybe that's an interesting thing, right, which is that like in a game like New Vegas, you literally are saying – I'm putting resources into being able to get out of these experiences nonviolently because
and that one in particular where you can avert like the conflict ending of New Vegas, like there's no other choice in the game that prepares you for putting 100
points.
Nothing else requires maximum speech. Yeah. Everything else in the game is below that threshold. And in no other stat in that game would you ever even think you're supposed to spread your points out. You're not supposed to max
100
out
points.
Like one of these.
Right.
And I remember like upon getting to that dialogue choice and not like having it in like whatever, probably the 90s or something like that, like not having enough, reloading an old save, grinding out to get that 100 going. But mostly because I was just fascinated it existed as an option. I was like, what? Like you can avert like the ending, all the narrative that this game has been building to and like the preceding hours can just be like sidelined if you've maxed out a stat, which is an interesting way, unsurprising that it's Obsidian, like to have approached that sort of
resolution. I love Obsidian so much.
Yeah.
Ugh.
There's some good stuff.
They do.
It sounds like Obsidian and Eastern European developers have a better idea of this than anybody else.
I think it's this double A space or whatever, whatever you want to call this. This like this
interesting with a budget.
Interesting with a budget,
yeah.
Right? The seven out of tens. The space of like, hey, we don't. One of our goals is not to appeal to the widest consumer base audience. Like we're sustainable if we hit a smaller, you know, a smaller target number than that. And also probably just filled with people on those teams who have like a weird devotion to whatever their vision is, instead of, I don't know. I can't judge dev teams. It could be about product. It could be about, you know, a publisher not getting involved. It could be about a lot of different things.
What we know about development. Right. Yeah, it kind of has to almost be a not massive, giant behemoth team for that to even be possible.
To where it's going to get tested out of, into oblivion. Right, or like you said, just so many people that like you just lose it in the numbers.
Yeah.
Well, in a bunch of these examples, Metro, Stalker, Witcher, they're all games that are referring to other materials and other media.
Fair.
Like, this is the thing, is so they're trying to recreate an experience that already has a great deal of moral ambiguity and grayness to it. Whereas I suspect like there's a tendency to like provide good design feedback when it comes to designing your morality system. So like if there's unintended consequences, if you're like approaching it like a lot of game designers, well shit, this is broken because like the player doesn't know that they're bad.
Right.
The player doesn't know that they're like being a shitty person. We did not communicate that effectively. Whereas like if you're making a game about the Witcher series or the Metro series, it's like, hell yeah. Like You fell into a dark path.
Right.
You didn't know it because you thought you were the hero.
Yeah. It's funny. Even Obsidian stuff that I think about is at their best is like putting New Vegas up against Fallout 3, putting KOTOR 2 up against KOTOR 1. Like it's also about referencing some outside work. And not that the people at Obsidian had nothing to do with previous Fallout games. Obviously, right. There's a lineage there. But in KOTOR 2 especially, it's like, this is literally a response to KOTOR 1 in some ways.
It's the subversion of your expectation of like a piece of media whether it's a game or a novel. And that's actually what makes like The Witcher 3 doesn't exist without like that the lineage of those first two games and then building upon it. And that's what – I never even thought about Metro in this capacity. Like, that makes me I mean – Metro Exodus is already far and away like the most excited I am for a game in 2018 because of the lineage of those games.
Rob is bouncing. And I just want to add that in.
Yeah,
he is bouncing.
There exists a world like we don't know if we live in it yet, but there exists a world where like Metro takes the same sort of leap that like Witcher did, like but in thinking of Metro and plopping that into an open world, like the kind of questions that Metro asks, the kinds of things that Metro does, plopping that into a larger like context that will not only benefit folks like myself or other people, you know, like Rob and like at Waypoint that like those games, but broadens it out where other people who are like, I just like open world shooters, post-apocalypse, I'm
sure.
In. And like, you know, same, you know, we're going to talk about Black Panther next week. Like, same thing like Black Panther does. Like, yo, you want to see a superhero? Like, let's talk about colonialism.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, that makes me very excited for what they can. I really hope they pull it off. I hope
they
can pull The Witcher 3, which is like, hey, like take what was unique about these games and fucking slap it in this giant open world, which is already a cool concept, but just the fucking wild things they could do would make me. I hope they pull it off. Me too.
There's a lot of things maybe in this space this year. I think about State of Decay 2 also seems like they want to go that route. One of the things that they talked about is that there are factions in that game, which previously was not a thing at all. They're partially procedurally generated and are fundamentally about ideology. Like, what separates them is, like, the things that they are willing to do to survive in a post-apocalyptic setting. And, like, obviously this is very trope-filled and very kind of tread territory, which means that there's always the possibility that they just walk down paths that we find boring because they've been walked down so many times before. But given the first game's strengths around procedural storytelling, around kind of painting a lot with just a little bit of color, I'm hopeful that they actually move in that same space to where, you know, one of the things I love that games can do sometimes is offer us like equally bad or equally frustrating, equally compromised alternatives to where you don't get the speech 100 option at all sometimes. What you get is like three options, all of which seem feasible.
Three
but
races of space slaving justice.
Right.
You know?
Like, literally. Like, it's funny. Like, we got the three. Now, our hope is we're going to hit a fourth group that is going to be an ally and going to help us like – you know, eke out some better existence or slide away. Like, what's probably going to happen is one of those space slavers is going to have a slave faction rise up and break away and we can support them and that can turn into a whole fucking thing. But in the case of Stellaris, the thing that definitely did happen is like there are now three of those factions. We can see what all of their ethics are, like what they're interested in. And there's one that's like straight up, they're with us when it comes to like science and technology and research. They're materialists like us, and they're only regular authoritarians. The other two groups are fanatic authoritarians, and so it's like, can we move them? Can we push them further away from authoritarianism? It doesn't even need to be all the way to egalitarianism. Can we just make them like
not have slaves?
Not have slaves.
Yeah, that's all.
What if we made them militaristic and instead of authoritarian? Still not great. Still not necessarily what we're looking for.
What if we just went into Libya and like got rid of their leader and like it'll all be fine.
It's gonna work
it's
out.
Fine. Just let them figure it out. Let them figure it out.
It was not fine. Our intentions were good.
Yeah.
And so really, if there were consequences for others, like what they should bear in mind is that we really wished everyone the best.
We really wanted everything to go well for everybody involved.
I mean, seriously, though, like, as much as we, like, joke about, like, that, like, you know, neocon liberals, like, sort of, like, interventionalist perspective, like, you see how you arrive at those things,
totally,
right? Like, it's super easy to sit in MOG and lots of reasons to criticize those decisions, but, like, the way you guys are talking about your Solaris games, like, you see how you end at those horrible choices.
I've told this choice before. I've told the story before, so I'm going to do it very quickly. But one of the first games of Solaris I played in, I ended up bringing in – I rescued a vassal nation, a nation from another – like, it was in another war. Kind of became really good friends with them, brought them in as a vassal state for myself, and then eventually just totally assimilated them. Because, like, as a vassal, they weren't full citizens in my empire, right? They weren't, like – they weren't getting all the benefits
that
I had.
They didn't have all their rights and liberties.
Right. But then once they were part of it, of my culture, they were like, they didn't like the way I did certain things and were voting against me and were like making things really difficult. And it was basically a group of six population units spread across three planets in the same sector, which we haven't gotten to yet, Danielle, but
right.
You eventually start sectoring off as you get a bigger and bigger empire.
Arms of your
empire. Yeah, because it's like, I can't control eight planets at once. So this was like one sector. And I was like, well, they're winning that sector. Like, even though it's only six people, they're so unified on this one issue. They have this, they're one issue voters. They're going to win that vote. And so
they really like their guns.
So what I ended up doing was I redistricted. I fucking gerrymandered them and broke them into three districts where now they were minority voters and they couldn't move
this
the chains.
This is how
anymore.
Trump won.
It's terrible. It's terrible.
Oh no!
But they didn't see the big picture.
Oh no!
They didn't see it. They didn't understand. Like, I get it. They didn't want, it was specifically, if I remember right, they didn't want robots. They were like, "Get the fucking robots off our planet!" And I was like, "No, have you
met me?" I see.
It
was about robots. Okay,
I love robots.
Makes sense now.
And so, get the fuck out of here. And so, like, it was like, "Well, I'm not going to kill these spore people. I'm not going to, and I'm also not going to let them riot in the streets because I have robots. Robots are cool. I'm a cool robot guy." And so, I turned one district into four or three or whatever, and then they were quiet. And here's the real here's the real fucked up thing, and the thing that I love about games like this.
Yeah.
300 years later or something, I redistricted it so that they were all one big district again. There was a new president in my cult. It was actually an oligarchic thing, so it was like a new chairwoman of the mega corporation that I was playing as. And she redistricted it and like made sure everyone had equal rights and all that. But it had been 300 years and they just sat in like culture for 300 years. So by the time that happened, they were good with robots.
Oh.
They'd lost that part of their culture completely. And so she got to come in as this great reformer as if I hadn't done this terrible hundreds of years long campaign of kind of slowly
silencing
enculturating them into our silencing them and then acculturating them into my view. So
wait, were the robots sentient?
Yeah.
Okay, but what you did was you protected the rights of one population from oppression by a minority population denied them their sentience, their value.
Cheers to that. That's what I'm saying.
See, this is why Rob is the evil Jiminy Cricket.
Mm-hmm. You see, benevolent Austin is pointing to this editorial that he saw in the newspaper that is explaining his argument very well for him.
What if you could own...
Thank you, National
what
Review.
What if you could own a robot, you know? What if you could have your own robot? That was the Politico story from a few weeks ago.
It was.
Right?
It sure was.
Fuck God.
Oh, my
anyway,
God.
Anyway, but like, I do love that about
it's
these
good.
Games. It's like, they get you to that point where you're like, fuck, how do I solve this? Oh, I just do. Oh, no. What did I just do?
You do the ultimate Republican weapon.
So as someone that doesn't play nor have any interest in playing those types of games, I love hearing these stories. Mm-hmm. And I wish – traditional is the wrong word. I wish other games would take
– Right.
Try and find ways to introduce that sort of like moral compromise storytelling and get that into other games. It seems like it's obviously a little bit easier to do just by the very structure of strategy games and the way that like assets work in strategy games, just like on a fundamental level. But there doesn't seem to be any good reason that more genres couldn't have that kind of like pushing the player into doing fucked up things, even if they think they're doing it for the right reason. I mean, we've mentioned The Witcher. Witcher actually is very good at providing you with like, you know, the go read up about like, you know, the Bloody Baron quest. Like, no matter what you do in that quest, things are bad. And like you resolve it, but like the resolution, like there isn't necessarily, there's not one path that's like, everyone's happy.
Fucking sucks.
I did all the stuff.
There's no way through that. The Bloody Baron quest is wild because like that dude is an abuser and is like actually terrible. And there is not a right way through that quest. It just sucks. It just sucks. It's
I don't
so
think
rough.
Anybody's ever happy no matter what you do in that quest. Like I don't I'm know that there
happy.
Are even happier and
it.
Less.
God damn it, Rob.
Of course Rob did. Rob had the Rob path. Yeah.
Why isn't this stuff, or not why isn't it, but I think about something like the War Table in Dragon Age Inquisition, which is this like bird's eye view of nations and cultures hitting each other, where this sort of stuff could totally come up more often. It does come up here or there, I don't want to be clear, but like it's one of those things that I'd love to see those games hit even more.
That'd be awesome. I mean, throughout the years, I loved the Mass Effect games at the time, and I enjoyed the Dragon Age games at the time as well. But it feels like over the years, it's become more and more obvious that those games are absolutely one of their player experience goals is always making you feel rad.
Right.
Like, even when it kind of Dragon Age obviously delves a little bit further on this towards the you're not always rad, but you're really rad underneath, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
totally.
It would be cool to see BioWare actually go for, like, no, actually, you can screw up and, like, feel bad about it.
Yeah.
And feel bad because you screwed up.
Well, so doesn't Dragon Age 2, though, kind of explicitly, like, explain why one of your buddies gets radicalized and takes a path of, like, extreme violent resistance?
Yeah, I think Dragon Age 2, I like Dragon Age 2 more than most people. But I think that the Anders storyline, which is the thing you're talking about, is, like, a kind of a drop ball in their execution. I think all of their Mage Templar shit in that game is fucked because they do a really bad job compared to both Dragon Age Origins and Dragon Age Inquisition at making the Templars seem like real people, and at the same and because of that, the mages seem so in the right completely.
Yeah.
And especially given what happens after, at the very end, there's a whole boss fight that is like so like it makes the bad choices that you know you're supposed to think are bad choices seem totally feasible and legit because of how bad things go. It's weird. Like, I don't know. I think that game's actually at its best when it's making you pissed at your friends for doing things that are – there's a second or third act thing that happens regarding one of your characters, Isabel, and the Kunari, who are like the people there from the north. They have their big iron bull is one of those in Inquisition. Big horn, they have horns. They're culturally this mashup of kind of Islam and communism. That's kind of the pitch. That's kind of like the very short and dirty meets. And they're rad, one. They're kind of a theocratic nightmare sometimes, too, to be clear. But she steals something very important from them. And there's a really good moment in that game where you're just like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, how could you bring this into our fucking house? Like, you know that this is just going to cause, like, some bullshit over your selfish ass. Like, ugh. And you have to end up making choices that are like, where is my morality? Where is my loyalty to my friends? How does all that mix together? What do I feel like ethically? I think that stuff works super well in that game. I really wish they stuck the landing on the kind of radicalized buddy thing a little bit more.
Yeah.
I like Dragon Age 2 more than most people, though. So.
Yeah.
I speak from a place of love.
It's from a place of love. It's criticism from a place of love.
That's what we try to do here most of the time.
Most of the time. I think we have time for maybe one question. Unless,
sure.
All right. It is a highly relevant question to both our discussion today-ish and also life in general. So I didn't get their name, so if this is you, good job. With Bayonetta out on the Switch now, I'm playing through it for the second time. I found that this game speaks to my younger self in an unexpected way.
Hmm.
I grew up in a small town in Texas and attended church services every Sunday. When I was a kid, I remember zoning out in church and imagining battles between heaven and hell. Now I'm an atheist that never attends church, but Bayonetta takes those childhood daydreams and infuses them with the Japanese style that I find positively delightful. Have you ever played a game that really unintentionally reminds you of your childhood? I just, like, I think about this because I definitely had an extremely Catholic upbringing and had a lot of those same daydreams about, like, oh, yeah, let's check the angels kicking demons' asses, which is not really the point, but it seems cool when you're six. I don't know.
I'm trying to think of an answer to that question, though, of just, like, is there anything that takes me back to childhood? I, like, you heard me rail about Dynasty Warriors the other day, and, like, that's because one of the things I like is that those games take me back to my childhood when they – of just, like, endless summers where I'm just going to level up all of my characters to 99 or whatever because I have all this time. I'm just going to, like, throw myself at them. And this one failed to do that. So not that one.
Not that one.
I don't know. I don't know. I feel like the types of games I play now are just so different that they don't
– Yeah. Like, I often find that I'm deliberately – like, I have no interest. Like, a lot of those games – I mean, I like Mega Man. I like platformers, action games, a lot of, you know, JRPGs that I played when I was a kid. But my interests are just, like, so completely different from, like, both as a function of time and interest that, like, occasionally I'll dip my toe into things that remind me of my childhood. But, like, by and large, it's like I want to play things that adult Patrick finds interesting, which just don't often line up with what younger Patrick spent his time.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Yeah. I guess we could broaden this out and think about, like, even themes or even, you know, like some sort of flavor, even if it's not like the game.
Sports is just the one for me, which is, like, I grew up playing a ton of sports games. I mean, my dad would play, you know, Madden, or before that we would play Game Day, or before that we would play Joe Montana football on Sega, and before that we played, like, Tecmo Super Bowl. So, like,
on Sega. You played it on Sega, huh?
Montana? Yeah, I played Montana.
I was just
a Sega. Yeah.
I know, I'm just saying.
Sega
growing up.
Holy shit.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
That was wonderful. It took back. You right back.
That's totally it.
But that's one – but, like, yeah, I mean, like, for people that, like, didn't – who might be a lot of people listening to this podcast didn't grow up in that era, like, people that, like – there were one, there were people that Nintendo and people at Sega – they had a Genesis. Okay. And the Nintendo people often made fun of the people that had a Genesis because it's not exclusive, but it tended to be, let's say, 3/4 people had Nintendo, 1/4 people had Genesis, and the people who had Nintendo would say, like, your parents just didn't know what to buy you, and they got you the goddamn Genesis.
They're wrong.
People that were,
to be clear,
I love
Genesis filled with great games.
I later came to love my Genesis, and the Mortal Kombat was the way the Genesis people got to rub salt in the wound of Super Nintendo.
Their green
wounds is filled with the Metro 2033s and the Stalkers and the Witchers of that era, 100%. Like, no wonder
I just wanted to make the point that when you said the Sega, like, that's
what it means.
That was super
really
common
funny.
Back then. Like, I was saying, like, that was deliberate. That, like,
that
you, like,
good.
Had, like, it was a nervous tick that just went, like, whoop, like, the Sega.
Yeah, on Sega, of course.
It was on
that's
Sega.
What we did.
Two, that is too
it did
funny.
Teleport me back. But, yeah, that's what we did. Like, so I think sports games, like, when I go and play Madden, when I play FIFA, those are the games that I played the most when I was still, like, before college, you know? Not the most, but I played them the most in my life in that time period. So even now when I dip my toes back in, those probably work for me in that way.
How about you, Rob? Anything bring you back? Even if it's just, like, the flavor of something or the theme?
Yeah, I mean, like, I'm sort of in the I had a lot of weird tastes for a kid that began to make more sense as I became, like, an adult
this.
Man.
Yeah.
Like,
I love this.
So you're saying you were playing, hexagonal strategy games when you were in fifth grade?
Yeah, basically. Like, you know, the sight of, like, French infantry breaking into assault columns and closing with a redcoat position. Like,
this.
That takes me right the fuck back to age, like, 6 or 7.
Third grade.
So in some ways, like, I failed to grow up and evolve because, like, to this day...
You were,
like,
already there.
Yeah, the flags unfurl, the soldiers, like, marching across the battlefield. I'm like, oh, my heart. Yep.
My 12th birthday.
Nobody came, but I was there. And so were my fellow soldiers.
Oh, Marshal Davout, you're my real friend.
Perfect.
Wow.
That's nice. That means you get to travel back to your youth every time you play a game, you know?
It's beautiful. It's good. It's really beautiful. There's something there for me that I can't fully articulate, but I truly loved this horrible edutainment game when I was a little kid. Mario is Missing. It was like a geography game that I honestly love. And there's some bits and pieces that I feel in the world of games. Like, I haven't looked at the museum mode yet of Assassin's Creed Origins, but like the way it's all like, here's some facts about a thing. Right. That's exactly how the edutainment part of Mario is Missing was presented. So I feel like I would get a little bit of that. And I honestly love that kind of shit. I am the biggest dork for like museums and just encountering artifacts and having a little bit of context given to me. And that like, it's like a little shot of context. I don't know.
Yeah, it's
something about it was very appealing.
I'm here for it. Rob wrote about that this week too. People should go read that on the site.
Exactly. All right, everybody. Well, I think that's probably it for our Friday podcast. Of course, you can always send questions to us at gaming@vice.com with the subject question. Thank you for all the good questions that we get. I know we've gotten some interesting questions about our last podcast, but keep sending those good questions that ask us actual questions. Shout outs, of course, to Boen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We are on Twitter at Waypoint. We are on Facebook at Waypoint Vice and YouTube at Waypoint Vice. And, of course, you can read everything we write at waypoint.vice.com. You can find me at Danielle R.I. Austin, where can people find you online?
At Austin_Walker.
Awesome. Patrick, where can we find you?
Find me at Patrick.
Rob.
Marching with the Grand Armée.
At Rob Zachney.
Good. Very good. Thank you, everyone, for being here with us. And, as always, I would like to send you off for your weekend by saying be good and be good at it.
Vive l'Empereur.
Peace.